even though we stereotype serial murderers as all white dudes, we don't apply that to individual white men, right? We don't go around thinking any white dude you see is going to be a potential serial killer, because I think we understand that that would be silly and actually wouldn't be helpful in catching serial murderers. But racism and the criminalization of Black people and Latino people in the inner city allows us to justify those types of things.
You are listening to New Ideas, an NEIU Libraries podcast about faculty research at Northeastern Illinois University. I'm your host, Ed Remus, the social sciences librarian at NEIU. In this episode, NEIU undergraduate student Maria Gonzalez interviews her former professor, David Springer. David has taught sociology classes at Northeastern for around 8 years while earning his PhD in sociology at the University of Illinois at Chicago. During that time, he has presented his work at the Association of Black Sociologists and at the Society for the Study of Social Problems. David's forthcoming dissertation is titled, Where Monsters Meet the Truly Disadvantaged, Race, Gender, and the Serially Killed. In the interview you're about to hear, David and Maria discuss a section of the dissertation in which David conducts a qualitative analysis of court documents in serial murder cases. David reveals the racial and gendered narrative scripts that are used to frame serial murders and argues that these scripts can help us understand why Black people, and specifically poor Black women, are uniquely exposed to serial murder. Here now is Maria Gonzalez with David Springer.
Start off with, can you just tell us why you chose this topic to study?
So I usually start like the talks that I've done when I'm discussing my dissertation research by pointing out how like a lot of people start their research, at least in sociology, a lot of people start with topics that are like close to them. So like people who grew up Black and middle class will study the Black middle class, right? Or people who may have been involved in gangs at one point in their life will research gang involvement. I have no personal connection to serial killer. I'm not a serial killer, never have been, and I don't know anybody who's been murdered by a serial killer, knock on wood. So I didn't really have a personal connection to the subject, but I think like most people, I always found like serial murder interesting because it is so rare. And the consequences of it are so drastic. And, you know, I'm not that old, but I can vaguely remember what life was like when Jeffrey Dahmer, when that case kind of came to national prominence and like how big of a deal it was. Like, even though I was only like 6, 7 years old at that time, like I remember hearing people talking about it. So I think that I originally became as fascinated with it for the same reasons as everybody else. And then around the early 2000s, when you start to see like this huge boom in true crime media. So I know Serial was one of the first like big podcasts that like just blew up. And I feel like since then we've seen just all these different true crime documentaries and podcasts and things like that coming out from big cases like the Jeffrey Dahmer case to, you know, random, like there are literal podcasts about small towns and like murders that take place there, you know? So I was consuming a lot of that stuff at the same time. And then the Black Lives Matter movement comes along and a lot of people are pointing out that, you know, victims of police brutality, especially Black male victims, deserve a lot of attention. But you have these other groups of people who have their lives devalued, Black women, Black queer people, people who are marginal in some other ways within the Black community. And so I'm listening to these podcasts on like a Jeffrey Dahmer, some of the other cases that are in my dissertation, I'm sure we'll talk about. It's like the Cleveland Strangler case. There's a man named Cleophas Prince out of San Diego, and Gary Ridgway, who killed mostly up in Seattle. And even some cases of Canadian serial killers, South African ones, ones from the UK. The pattern that kept emerging was it was almost always somebody who was marginal in some way. They were targeting women, they were targeting gay men, they were targeting sex workers, they were targeting migrant workers. It was always people like that. And so since I had known for a while that the stereotype about serial murders being all white dudes wasn't true, I decided to dig into these serial murder cases in Black communities, whether the killer be Black or not. And I found a lot of patterns that many different scholars, I think, have tried to highlight over the past decade or so after the death of Trayvon, with the way that law enforcement works, the way that poverty puts people at risk for certain types of violence, so on and so forth.
So great. So you would say this was like a process over time that you kind of been aware of these issues. Mm-hmm. And I think all of us have as well. So I am glad that we're talking about this and digging a little deeper. So as for the research methods that you did in this study, can you describe why you chose those particular methods?
I've always been interested in like how we tell stories. And I actually had another dissertation that I started, and this is rare, and I highly suggest that anybody who's ever thinking about a PhD not do this, but I started one dissertation and then kind of dropped it because my heart wasn't in it. But that dissertation involved interviewing people and basically hearing their life stories. And I've always been interested in the stories that people tell about themselves, about the things that happen around them. And more specifically, I was always interested in like the images that keep coming up in these different stories and like the things that get used as like shorthand. I watch like a lot of movies, and a decent amount of like people who review movies for a living or people who've been to film school or whatever will talk about how like shorthand gets used a lot in films, even if it's not necessarily accurate. So like, this is a random stupid example, but the movie Hercules, when he goes to Zeus and he kneels to pray, that's not most likely what a Greek person during that time period would have done. They probably would have sacrificed like a goat or something like that. But you use prayer as shorthand because that's what your audience, mostly Americans, that's what we think of when we think of like someone praying to a deity or trying to communicate to a deity. So from a more sociological standpoint, I became more interested in some of the ways in which stereotypes can become shorthand, right? So how ideas about like a gangbanger, racialized ideas about like serial killers being all white dudes, how do these things come up in these different cases? And how do they sort of emphasize certain ideas, certain traits, certain types of people, and how do they omit certain cases, right? So like, you know, why do we know so much about like a Ted Bundy or a Jeffrey Dahmer, but not as much about the Cleveland Strangler? Or there's a man who just passed away recently in Los Angeles, the Grim Sleeper was his name. Lonnie Franklin was his actual name, but he was nicknamed the Grim Sleeper. So I think what often happens with these types of things is like when you have set up a stereotype and you have these images of what a certain type of crime looks like, usually you only emphasize it within a certain context and you omit it from others. So like I said, with gangbangers, when you think of a gangbanger, you probably think of a young Black or Latino kid, but you're not thinking about like the white supremacist gangs, of which there are like a ton, who are just as dangerous and like just as criminally involved, right? But that's not the script that we've provided ourselves. And you know, this comes up with terrorism and how we think of that. And especially, like I said, with serial murder, because we assume it's like a white thing. These cases that involve the disappearance of, you know, dozens of Black people, and especially as I talk about in my research, Black women and poor Black women, those types of things get left out. So I thought it would be a good idea to take the news articles, the books that have been written on the subject, and some of the legal documents, if you can get a hold of those, and just go through them and see what kind of patterns were emerging and what kind of stories were being told about these different cases.
Gotcha. And I like how you mentioned the movie Hercules. That has me wondering, is there like another like particular movie that like you remember watching and just really like thinking to yourself, like, wow, these stereotypes are ridiculous?
Mm-hmm. Recently, I have been very, and I think this sort of squares up with my research because crack use, and we'll talk about that later. I think the depiction of crack and the depiction of crackheads has been something that's really been kind of getting under my skin a lot more recently. Part of that is because I think, and many people have pointed this out, that the coverage of like the opioid crisis appears to be much more sympathetic than, you know, the crack epidemic and the Just Say No era. And I don't think the way that people talk about the opioid crisis is necessarily perfect, but I think crack was villainized and the people who used it were villainized that way. And being somebody who grew up on, for lack of a better term, like hood movies, so movies like Boys in the Hood, Colors, Menace to Society, classics like that. New Jack City is one of the biggest examples of this, where they depict crackheads in a very specific way. It's like they're either comic relief, and in those movies, oftentimes comedians play that role. So Chris Rock in, you know, New Jack City, or they're depicted as like repulsive. So they're dirty. It's a lot of the stereotypes that we associate with the homeless, where like, you know, they have some form of psychosis, they're dirty, and of course that they're dangerous. And so that has been something that I think has soured a lot of these different hood movies that come out for me, because I think a lot of them obviously were groundbreaking. Like Boys in the Hood was a really big deal in terms of depicting that kind of life, you know, of Black people poor in the inner city, in the ghetto, or whatever you want to call it. That's like really important. But I think some of the themes in those movies overlapped with general political discourse about drug users, and it kind of fit with the times where we're justifying over-policing these areas. We're justifying the war on drugs and things like that. And one of the ways in which you do that is by presenting the enemy as, you know, immoral, as depraved, so on and so forth. And I think a lot of that, I've been thinking about it more recently because in the Cleveland Strangler case, a lot of the victims, there are 11 of them killed by a man in Cleveland, and they all were women with drug addictions. And this is something that is emphasized in the coverage of them. And in some instances, it's not necessarily something that I think presents them as particularly sympathetic. It's like, it's less like these were women who were struggling with addiction and that put them at risk, although there's a little bit of that. But it's almost like the women were at fault for what happened to them because of their addiction. So yeah, I think that that's been, and the fact that I have people in my family who struggle with addiction as well, I think has kind of put a bit of a damper on some of those movies.
Right. Yeah, so this leads me into my next one. You mentioned how there is a common notion that people with brain damage and mental health problems are more likely to commit crimes. And this is like a widely known idea. So mm-hmm. How do you think that this prevents us from seeing the root causes of serial murders?
So I was watching, speaking of movie reviews, I was watching one about how trans people have been depicted throughout history in cinema, and how the classic movie Psycho, and just mild spoilers for Psycho, the movie came out in like 1960, so I guess, I don't know if people don't know it, whatevs. But in Psycho, you find out that the killer has been dressing up like their mother, and that their mother's actually been dead, because you start out thinking that the mother is the killer, but it's actually the son, and he's been dressing up like his mother while he murders people. And a lot of that was borrowed from this case in Wisconsin of Ed Gein, who was a man who I think killed two or three people. But he also had like a bunch of body parts, some of which I think were from his murder victims, and then others that he had dug up and gotten from like women's graves, you know? So it's, I'll spare you all the details, but it's gross, right? Ed Gein also liked to cross-dress. And so that's where, and a lot of people have said that like the idea of like Leatherface and Jason Voorhees, and of course the protagonist whose name escapes me in Psycho, Norman Bates,
I think. Bates, yeah.
You start to see ideas from Ed Gein finding their way into media. And it's so interesting to me that with Ed Gein, like what stuck about him and what people were super concerned about was his cross-dressing, right? Ed Gein wasn't gay. Ed Gein wasn't what we would call trans today. I think he's just a dude who liked wearing women's clothes occasionally. That became the focal point for a lot of different people. And I think that's part of why you see that image of like a man dressing up like a woman coming up a lot in media. And so I think that that's a really good example of how, especially when a crime is perceived as being mostly committed by white men, and we assume that white men are like a default in society, we don't have a built-in explanation for why they would do something like that, right? So when Black people do something, it's like, oh yeah, Black people are naturally violent. Some people might say biologically violent. Some people might say culturally violent. Whatever the case is, like there's a built-in explanation for that. With mentally ill people, same thing. Mentally ill people are often stigmatized and thought to be dangerous. So that gives you something to pin their violence on, even if it had nothing to do with why they actually committed that act of violence. But because white men are like the default, we have to find something else that explains the violence away. And so I think we're very good at finding like other parts of these people to pin this deviance on, instead of looking more critically at how being a member of the dominant group might actually be conducive to committing this type of violence. Because upwards of like 90%, more than 90% of all serial killers are dudes. And so I think that confronting masculinity, specifically like toxic masculinity, and you know how it encourages people to prey on those who you perceive as weaker, is something that doesn't come up a ton in terms of talking about why serial murders might take place and how, in some specific cases, being a white man actually is what allows you to be seen as normal and thus evade detection or vision and evade capture. Because you see that happening again and again, and you hear it so much, even in serial killer cases that don't involve white men, you'll hear people talk about, he was normal, he seemed really nice, he was fine, he was nice to me, so on and so forth. And so I think we have a tendency to want to find something else about a person, their sexuality, their gender identity, their mental illness or lack thereof. We're always trying to find something else to pin these things on that's a little bit more comforting than looking a bit closer at, you know, masculinity or how being a straight dude might contribute to these types of violence.
Right. So it seems like this idea about mental health being the issue is only applied when it's like a white man. And then if not, then because there are obviously, you know, Black people have mental health issues, but like if they're committing crimes, it doesn't seem like they really talk about the mental part. Like you said, more just like, oh, that's just how it is. That's how they are. So yeah, it's definitely differing views about setting rules to certain people. And so yeah, that's a big issue, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and like I said, I think the people with mental health are already like criminalized and stigmatized. I mean, like with eugenics, the pseudoscience that was eugenics, they obviously sterilized like a lot of Black people, and that led to a number of different crimes against humanity that targeted the Black community, but it was also people with mental illnesses and intellectual disabilities as well. So I think a lot of it, like I said, is just like trying to find something else so that we don't have to confront how members of the mainstream, being a member of the mainstream, being a member of this group that we think of as neutral, or in a lot of cases good, how that might contribute to these types of crimes.
Yeah. So another point that you mentioned is that serial murders are often gendered violence in relation mm-hmm. to racism and structural vulnerability. Can you elaborate more on this term, structural vulnerability, and why it puts Black people, especially Black women, in harm's way for serial murder?
Right. So in the case of Jeffrey Dahmer, a lot of his victims, and this is one of the things that really started to pique my interest in serial murder of Black people, Jeffrey Dahmer, most of his victims were actually Black men. His MO was generally to go to a gay bar or something like that, offer people to come back to his place to take pictures or to have sex or whatever. And a lot of them went missing. Their families would ask, hey, what's going on? They would report them as missing. In some instances, like one boy named Conorak sent the home phone, he actually escaped, but he had been drugged. Police were called, and for whatever reason, the police released Conorak sent the home phone back into the custody of Jeffrey Dahmer, even though I think he was like 15 years old, right? So that case, I think, for me, highlights how people can be made vulnerable through these systems outside of themselves. So what I mean by that, especially in this specific case, is that if you're gay in like the 1980s and 1990s, there's still a huge stigma against you, and a stigma that the police might suffer from sometimes as well. That was in the middle of like the AIDS epidemic. So gay people, gay men specifically, had been highly demonized, in part because they were disproportionately impacted by the HIV and AIDS epidemic. But also, I think it just kind of brought a lot of different forms of homophobia to the surface. And some of that came through the medical industry, because like I think they thought it wasn't literally a gay disease at first, that it only happened to gay men. And obviously, like, we know that that's not true. But that's the context in which Jeffrey Dahmer is murdering. So there's not a lot of value being applied to gay men at this time. And because there's not a lot of value, there's not a lot of incentive to cover that case or investigate these cases in a lot of detail, because who cares if a Black gay dude disappears in a ghetto in Milwaukee, except for the people who are close to him? So when I talk about structural vulnerability, then I'm talking about how being marginalized puts one at risk for higher rates of physical and emotional suffering. So how being gay, and this in the Jeffrey Dahmer case, a better example of this actually is he was a registered sex offender well before he got caught with the bodies in his apartment. And he had actually been drugging people at a gay bathhouse. And I specifically want to highlight that it was a gay bathhouse, because even though he got caught doing this, no one really came forward, because at that time, no one wanted to out themselves as gay. So in that way, gay men, and Dahmer probably knew this on some level, gay men on the margins of society, less likely to be believed. And if they had come out, they probably would have had to deal with problems at work, problems with their family, who knows what types of issues they were facing. So they were incentivized to keep quiet, and that allows Jeffrey Dahmer to continue to prey on gay men. And it ends with, I think, 16, 17 different deaths. And in the case of an Anthony Sowell or a Gary Ridgway, you have women who are vulnerable, many of whom had like traumatic backstories as well, which addiction is often like a symptom of some form of trauma that you've experienced. And like women who end up doing sex work, especially the type of sex work that puts you in danger, not like working on OnlyFans or something like that, but like, you know, working on the street, working in contexts where like physical violence is like a bigger risk. A lot of those women are, you know, marginalized. They're poor. Many of them have suffered some form of trauma. So because of that, those women are more likely to be put in harm's way because they're more likely to be targeted, because serial killers often know no one's going to care as much if these people disappear. And then even if they do find the bodies, or someone figures out that something's going on, who knows if the police are actually going to care. In the case of the Cleveland Strangler, a number of families went to the police from, you know, within like a couple miles of Anthony Sowell's home. And they were like, yo, they've disappeared. Can y'all look into this? And they told them, you know, the mandatory waiting period is still on, or like that happened in this district. Like there was always a passing of the buck somehow. And so when I talk about structural vulnerability, I'm talking about all of the ways in which people can be left vulnerable to both the physical and emotional suffering, and can be cut off from the symptoms that are meant to alleviate that sort of thing. Does that make sense?
Yes. So like a little side question. So the fact that Black women are more structurally vulnerable than Black men, you also mentioned that Black men in particular are still targets, but for more, not serial murders, but like murders, I think maybe in general. So why do you think the difference, would you say, like you said, maybe like sex work would be making the women more, more victims? Or do you think it would also have to do with the killers being mostly men, maybe, that find women easier targets?
Yes. I think that's a big part of it. There aren't many serial killers that I know of who targeted straight men. There obviously have been serial murderers who have killed straight men, but I don't know that there are a lot who do that exclusively. I think the Zodiac killer, who never got caught, might have killed, like they did kill straight people because they killed like couples. And the Son of Sam, I think, like shot some men as well. But for the most part, it's, you know, men killing women. But I think the example of the sex workers is a really good example of this, because if you start with just in an ideal world, I do this a lot with my students, actually. I think this is always a good place to start when you're trying to tease apart how some problems are more sociological in nature and where people might be structurally vulnerable. Just kind of think about how a process should look ideally, when there are infinite resources and no biases to speak of, right? So person goes missing. Ideally, people close to that person, they go to the police. The police investigate. Maybe you notice that there is a pattern and a number of people have gone missing, right? You go, you do the police work that it takes. You notice like this one person keeps popping up over and over again. And then you kind of take it from there in terms of like building a case against that person, investigating them, so on and so forth, right? So in the case of Anthony Sowell, he's targeting women who are already vulnerable, because where this was happening, it was a, for lack of a better term, it was a ghetto. It was a poor, predominantly Black, almost exclusively Black area. And if you know anything about residential segregation, like, you know, it's not just, it doesn't just concentrate Black people, it concentrates a number of different forms of hardship, poverty, a lack of educational opportunity, so on and so forth. So when you have higher rates of, I don't even think there are higher rates of like child abuse or domestic violence in Black communities, but like the safety net in those areas is obviously not there. So that makes people more likely to do illegal activities like sex work. And because it's something that occurs mostly on the Black market, you don't have any legal recourse. So you're more vulnerable to violence because of that. If somebody steals money from you as a sex worker, like you can't go to the police for that. And it's the same with like dealing drugs. So you're more at risk for violence in that context. And then all of the structures, the police, law enforcement, everything that's meant to help people like you theoretically might be actually biased against you. And you might not even want to talk to the police sometimes because they don't always show that they care. Or perhaps you've heard and experienced before women going to the police and not actually getting help and actually being like arrested and criminalized themselves. So I think when I'm talking about like structural vulnerability, I'm mostly talking about how placing these individuals in these, when you place these individuals in these systems, they're more vulnerable to all of this suffering, but also more likely to lack the means to adequately address that suffering.
Yeah, that makes sense. So another term I want to ask you about, dog whistle racism. Mm-hmm. And you used this regarding how the murderers and victims were described in the court reports. Mm-hmm. Can you explain this term and how it was displayed in your findings?
Yeah, so I was reading a court document and an appeals document in the case of Cleophas Prince Jr. He was a serial murderer, the Black man who murdered mostly white women in Claremont, which is a neighborhood in San Diego. And he was not being particularly careful when he did all this. Multiple people saw him. I don't believe he was ever wearing a mask. He was doing this in the middle of the day. And he was caught several times trying to get women's doors open, like trying to, you know, break into people's apartments. And he was actually found with a lot of different jewelry and different like trophies or whatever they were to him before he was like arrested and obviously put away. But what started to pique my interest in that case specifically is how he was being depicted as particularly brazen, unsympathetic. Like there really wasn't anything in the court documents, at least, that suggested that this was somebody who like we should care about as a person. Whereas when you think about like Jeffrey Dahmer, a lot of the coverage, not all of it, but like a lot of the coverage of him is like kind of sympathetic. I mean, there are books written about what Dahmer was like as a teenager, right? And where some things might have gone wrong and where some wires might have been crossed, right? Which suggests to me like there's a level of sympathy that people have for him. This was not true in the case of Cleophas Prince, right? And another piece of that puzzle is that Cleophas Prince was targeting white women. And literally every woman in the court document, so this isn't a book, this isn't a novelization, this isn't a podcast, this is like a legal document. Every single woman was referred to as young, white, and some form of attractive or beautiful. So you have this Black man who some people referred to as well-built. He was, I think he was in the military. Well, that's kind of like buff, I guess. But you have this man being framed as like a brazen, unsympathetic, big Black dude targeting these young, attractive white women. You know, where have you heard that narrative before, right? That was, you know, one of the biggest sort of stereotype dynamics of lynching, the big Black guy murdering the docile, peaceful, pure white woman. Now, they never called him the N-word. They never used the term like Black brute. They never referred to white women as like pure or whatever. But the ways in which they were talking about it were kind of evoking that image. And I think with dog whistle racism, that's what it does in general, right? It's terminology that's race neutral on the surface, right? Gangbanger, thug, terrorist, illegal immigration, welfare queens, crackheads, crack babies, wolf killers, serial murders, right? None of those things have race written into the definition of them, right? There's nothing that says that serial killers have to be white people. There's nothing that says terrorists have to be Muslim. But our default, when we think of those issues, when we think of those groups of people, often depicts them as a specific racial group. So dog whistle racism, especially when it's used in political discourse, is meant to describe how these different terms, while neutral on the surface, signal something to people who might have a racial bias or people who are just straight up racist, right? So when you say, I'm going to fight terrorism, people know that means you're going to the Middle East. When I'm fighting the war on drugs, I know that means you're going to poor Black and Latino neighborhoods. You're not going to a college campus and put your butt beside people's heads, right? Illegal immigration is something that is mainly fought and targeting like Mexican immigrants or quote unquote Mexicans, right? As opposed to other groups of people. And there are a number of undocumented immigrants that come from other places. But when we think of illegal immigration or talk about quote unquote illegal immigrants, and I don't even like that term, but like when we do that, we're talking about very specific groups of people. And if you are somebody who's willing to use race to gain votes, and we have a lot of people in this country, I think, especially as we've seen over the past at least like 4 to 5 years, a lot of people who are willing to use race to garner support and garner votes, using that kind of language allows you to dog whistle to people, hey, I'm going after these bad people, not you. I'm going after those people in the quote unquote inner city. I'm going after the illegal immigrants. I'm going to be tough on terrorism, so on and so forth. But it also allows you to avoid being labeled as racist, right? Because you can always say, I just said I was fighting terrorism. I didn't say I was going only to the Middle East, right? So it's a very slippery form of racism, but it might be one of the more insidious ones because of the, it's plausible that people might not be talking about a specific racial group. But again, like in the Cleophas Prince case, it's, you know, you talk about a big black dude murdering white women, that's going to elicit a certain response from people in a way that it might not if you're talking about a black man killing another black man, for instance.
Right, so it's basically like saying something racist without actually saying it, but we all basically know what they mean when they say it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like with, you know, you talk about inner city neighborhoods. Inner city just means in a city, right? But, you know, here in Chicago, if you're talking about, you know, problems of the inner city, we're probably talking about Black and Latino poor neighborhoods on the South and West sides, right? People don't think of like a Lincoln Park or a Wrigleyville as the inner city, right? You'll think of the area around the United Center as the inner city or downtown with a loop or, you know, the Gold Coast. It's a very specific group of people, very specific set of conditions that are elicited with that label, but you never have to say anything that might get labeled as racist. And that allows you to sort of save face, I guess.
Right. Very sneaky. So you mentioned this a little bit earlier, the narrative about crack being a main issue in Black communities. So how are these ideas used to suggest that Black crime victims are at fault for the crimes committed against them?
Mm-hmm. So in the case of an Anthony Sowell, the Cleveland Strike, I think a lot of that overlaps with rape culture. And in rape culture, the default is to find something wrong with the victim. And I think that that is a dynamic that comes up a lot with like Black people and crime. There is an author, Chanel Miller is her name. So I don't know if you remember like some years ago, there's a case where a woman was sexually assaulted and her sexual assaulter was caught red-handed and he just happened to be a Stanford swimmer, right? And he got like 6 months, like a super lenient sentence. Chanel Miller, it turns out, she was anonymous until like much later when she started doing like some interviews. She did one with Oprah, I think, and maybe one on 60 Minutes. In her book, she talks a lot about her experiences and how even though her rapist was caught red-handed sexually assaulting her while she was unconscious, so many people were trying to, or so much of the prosecution was trying to find something to pin on her, right? That she had been drinking, how she was dressed, like the usual stuff that comes up with sexual assault. In her book, she talks about how something similar often happens with Black people, especially with like police brutality. The default is to try to find something wrong with the person that justifies that violence against him. And so I think with crack, if you sort of look beyond the individual and start to look at how groups of people, like the police, like politics, especially someone like the Ronald Reagan administration, people like that, when you're getting ready to fight this thing called a war on drugs, you need propaganda in a war, right? And so you have this drug, like I was talking about earlier, that's assumed to be immediately and intensely addictive. And there's debate as to whether or not it's even actually that addictive. Dr. Carl Hart, who's a neuropsychologist at one of the Ivy League schools, I believe, has talked about this, right? That like, if you get liquid cocaine and injected it, you would start to feel the effects of the drug almost immediately, right? And it's very similar to like heroin, where it's like you get higher quicker when you inject it versus sniffing it. And the same is true of cocaine, right? So it's more so about the method in which you take the drug and not the drug itself, because crack is just a form of cocaine. But when you show the drug as being tied to actual inner city violence, right? So it's not like they weren't making up that the drug trade was tied to these upticks in violence that we saw in the 70s, 80s, and early to mid 90s. But you depict the drug also as being particularly addictive, something that will immediately ruin your life, something that will make you sell your children, something that will make you steal from your parents, so on and so forth. Of course, we ignored, intentionally or unintentionally, we omitted that people who are addicted to pills do that. People who are addicted to cocaine, people who are addicted to any hard drug would do that sort of thing. But because crack was new, or it was perceived as new, it justified not only going into these areas and arresting people for a crime that everybody does, because there's literally no evidence that suggests that Black people do drugs or sell them more than anybody else. But it also allows you to take away these programs that are meant to help them, because that was something else that was happening at that same sort of time period. On one hand, the police are getting more aggressive, more militarized, right? This is when you start to see like tanks finding their way into the LAPD and places like that. But then you can also say these people, and I think this is where it overlaps with like a lot of discourse about like the welfare queen, right? Where it's like, these people aren't using and taking advantage of these programs. They're actually exploiting them. Why don't we take this money and use it on something else, right? And so it justifies, you know, rescinding the social safety, right? So all these programs that we were saying were a good thing back during the New Deal, right? When it was mostly white people, and especially like white immigrants who were accessing welfare benefits, or what we would call welfare today. Now you can take that money away from those programs and use it on other stuff, right? And that money did not find its way back into a lot of those inner city, right? It went into the pockets of a lot of the elite. And that's part of why we've seen the wealth gap grow over the past 30 or 40 years. It's not the only reason, obviously. But so crack, and crack being perceived as particularly dangerous, not only in terms of people who use it, but also the people who sell it, it helps justify all of these different things. So when Anthony Sowell comes along, you find out that he's been killing women who have addiction issues. And these are people in the police department, in the neighborhood in general, who have been raised to believe that crack addicts and people who have addiction problems are almost subhuman, that they don't deserve that kind of policing and protection, right? It's actually not that crazy to think that Anthony Sowell would get away with doing something like that, in spite of the fact that he was also a registered sex offender and had been put in jail for sexually assaulting and strangling a woman before, and that he had several run-ins with the police before he was actually caught, where women came forward and said, "This man assaulted me," but they weren't believed or charges were never filed. So I think, like I said, with rape culture, and especially as it applies to like Black people and Black women, we are very good as a society at finding a way to blame them for their own problems and their own demise. And we are especially good at doing that when it helps justify either something that makes people a lot of money or justifies keeping money or certain resources away from those groups of people.
Yeah, and it's interesting, like, when you compare that to, like, white neighborhoods, for example, like, how you mentioned, like, there is no real, like, data that shows one group does more drugs than the other, but I know that white people do tend to do cocaine, you know, but yet there's never this idea, oh, you know, like, cocaine is a white person problem, or, like, problem in the white neighborhoods. And, like, one could even argue that, like, college students in particular, white college students might even use that more often, you know, but, you know, you never hear about these narratives. It's only, oh, you know, Black people, crack, that's the only issue.
So. Yeah. And it's like cocaine is like that. I think ecstasy is like that. Like, when something is perceived as a party drug, it doesn't get stigmatized the same way. Even though I'm pretty sure ecstasy is, like, it's not good for you. Like, it's any sort of illicit substance probably isn't going to be good for you long term. I know that that specifically has, like, medical uses, I think, for, like, PTSD and things like that. But yeah, like, it's actually a really good point you brought up about how, like, you know, when a drug is considered or, like, sort of stereotyped as being something that white people do, it can be met with, like, a little bit more sympathy and a little bit more leniency. Maybe not, like, with meth, because, like, meth is assumed to be, like, a poor white person drug, or, like, one for, like, rednecks or hillbillies or whatever derogatory term people have for, like, poor white folks. But I think that also goes back to what I was saying earlier about, like, being on the margins of society. Like, because they're poor, like, they're treated in a way that's not exactly the same, but, like, similar to how Black people are, where anything they do can become stigmatized and can be used as grounds for discrimination. Whereas if you're a white dude with a cocaine habit in college, and even if you are, like, destroying your life and the people and that of the people around you, it's not perceived the same way as a Black woman with a kid or two who has developed a crack habit.
Right. And then mentioning college too, like, you would think that there would be a big issue about, like, all these rape cases happening in college campuses. Mm-hmm. They do. And I'm pretty sure a lot of them are by white men, and where you see a lot of drugs happening as well, but never do you hear any stories about, oh, you know, this being a problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think I mentioned in, you know, you taking classes with me before that, like, we don't think of a Wrigleyville, which is where the Chicago Cubs play, for those of you who might not be from Chicago, or where DePaul University is, where Northwestern University of Illinois at Chicago, the University of Chicago, with all of these places, I think we pretty much know that, like, sexual assault is a problem there, but we never think of those areas as, like, high crime areas, because rich, well-off, highly educated white people are not a criminalized population, right? So compare that to, you know, Black folks in the inner city and some of, like, the less well-off neighborhoods, or, like, a little village where I lived, or North Lawndale, directly north of that neighborhood. You can be criminalized for just standing around on a corner. You don't even have to be doing anything particularly illegal, but, like, you know, loitering can get you snatched up by the police in some of those instances, and sometimes even worse, right? But I think criminalization is, like, a really big part of this. Like, even what criminalization does is it makes it so that anything you do as a person on the margins can be viewed as a potential criminal act or something along those lines. Whereas when you're not that, even if you are committing crimes, you, the people you represent, the spaces that you inhabit, aren't criminalized, right? It's the reason why, like, you know, even though we stereotype serial murderers as all white dudes, we don't apply that to individual white men, right? We don't go around thinking any white dude you see is going to be a potential serial killer, because I think we understand that that would be silly and actually wouldn't be helpful in catching serial murderers. But racism and the criminalization of Black people and Latino people in the inner city allows us to justify those types of things. And when those groups of people are victims of crimes, it also allows you to say, oh, well, they were committing a crime, so they got what was coming to them. Or what would you expect when you were engaging in sex work or selling drugs? You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah, always pointing the blame. Mm-hmm. To conclude then, can you tell us about your future research? Will you be studying the same topic? And what kind of methods will you use to study it?
Most likely, I have heard that when you get your PhD, that your dissertation kind of follows you around for some years after that. So most likely, I will be still studying serial murders. There is a case here in Chicago that the FBI and the Chicago Police Department have been working on. I think it's somewhere around 50 people, over 50 women who have been found in alleys, mostly strangled, I believe, on the south and west sides. And there's this thing called the Murder Accountability Project, where they look at, it's an algorithm that they have where they look at unsolved murder cases and ones that might have like a similar MO that are concentrated in specific areas, and sort of point those out as potential areas where there might be a serial killer active. And there was actually a serial murderer in Gary, Indiana, was called that way. I believe the case of Darren Van, he was caught in part because of that. And so there's a similar couple of cases happening here in Chicago. So I'll be keeping a pretty close eye on that. Also, a man by the name of Samuel Little, who passed away, I believe, earlier this year, is probably the most prolific serial killer. If his story check out, he might be one of the most prolific serial killers in U.S. history, having killed, I think he claimed somewhere around 90, like a little bit under 100 victims. Reading his story, I think it's a lot of the same themes that I've talked about today, where he's targeting marginal women, and because of that, he was able to just sneak away and get away from a lot of these things. It's by the fact that, you know, the police and prosecutors, like, people were trying to catch him, but because of these things that we have against addicts and women on the margins, he was able to get away with what he was doing for a very long time, to the point where he might be the most prolific serial killer of all time. Because I think the most we've gotten is somewhere around 50 with Gary Ridgway. And Samuel Little wasn't lying. He might be doing something like close to twice that. So I'll be keeping an eye on that case as well. Although, like I said, since he died, I don't know where the investigation will go. But also, something else that I don't know if this is less depressing than serial murder, but I don't know if you know anything about Jim Jones and like the Jonestown massacre, if you've heard of it at all. There was a it was a cult, like the phrase don't drink the Kool-Aid.
Oh, I heard of that.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, that comes from Jonestown. So basically what happened is he ran a cult that eventually moved from America to French Guiana, and it ended with a mass genocide. It was mass murder, because they forced some people to do this, where they all drank cyanide in a Kool-Aid or Flavor-Aid or something like that. So there is a racial component to that that I have been very interested in, because something I didn't know, and I didn't say this at the beginning, but I'm always interested in Black people who do things that we think Black people don't do. Part of what got me into serial murder, that's a weird way of putting that. One of the things that got me interested in studying serial murder was the idea that it was something that Black people didn't do. And I think also cults, like it's a thing only white people do, just not true. But in the case of Jonestown, I think what's particularly interesting is that Jim Jones actually started out as a civil rights activist, and like a legit one. So, you know, I imagine if you're in Indianapolis, segregated Indianapolis in like the 1940s or 50s, and this white man comes along and says, like, you deserve equality as a black person, and is actually putting his money where his mouth is in terms of helping people and in terms of like trying to show businesses that like his church has money and that they'll spend it there if they just allow, you know, black people to dine there, using his white privilege for good is something that really interests me, especially given what happens at the end of the story, which is, you know, hundreds of people, including like children dying. So the fact that there were like way more black people in his cult than I think we might assume fascinates me. And so I think that that will be something that I do a little bit of research on as well, especially because a lot of the information on that is publicly available.
So for your methods, you'll be like analyzing like the public information then?
Mm-hmm. It'll probably be something similar where I'm looking at how the case might be framed in books, who's portrayed as like sympathetic, who isn't, if there are any dog whistles. I don't expect it to happen as much because I expect that, you know, a lot of it will focus on him specifically. But yeah, I think there is a lot to unpack there that was happening in terms of race that doesn't get talked about as much in, you know, your typical podcast or documentary on the subject. But I think it probably overlaps with a lot of themes about structural vulnerability as well, because cults tend to go after people who feel alienated or marginalized from society. And if you're a black person in Indianapolis in like 1945, you probably felt that. And so I think somebody like Jim Jones was able to obviously exploit that with pretty horrific, horrific results. So at some point, maybe I will decide to actually study something that isn't awful and heartbreaking, but I think that's where I'm at for now. And I'm hoping maybe one day it might actually like help some people, but you know, we'll see.
You've been listening to Northeastern undergraduate student Maria Gonzalez interview David Springer, who teaches in Northeastern's sociology department. This episode was edited and produced by Maria Gonzalez. It featured samples of the song Tundra by Scanglobe. For more episodes of New Ideas, please visit us online at NEIU Digital Commons.